From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings. Women, workers, and vivisection in Edwardian England. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guest is Coral Lansbury of Rutgers University, Camden, where she serves as Distinguished Professor of English and Dean of Graduate Studies. Coral Lansbury is the author of essays and books on Victorian English literature. Her most recent novel is Felicity, published in the fall of 1987 by Dutton Press. Coral Lansbury, you have written a book called The Old Brown Dog. How in the world did an old brown dog come to represent, social and cultural tensions amongst feminists and medical people and working people in Edwardian England?
Well, let me tell you first how I came to hear about the old brown dog riots. I thought I knew about all the riots in England. I thought I knew about the Rebecca riots, the Luddite riots, the Chartist riots, and any other riots. After all, part of my background is that of a Labour historian. Mm-hmm. And then I was in the London Library, and I was just turning over some old Illustrated London News magazines, and I saw a picture of something called the Brown Dog Riots. And I thought, what in the name of heaven are the Brown Dog Riots? And then I discovered something that was quite extraordinary. A statue over a drinking fountain had been erected in the Latchmere Recreation Grounds in Battersea. Mm-hmm. And this statue of a small brown dog represented a terrier that had been vivisected twice at London University, which was contrary to regulation. After all, vivisection in England at this time was carried out under the 1876 Act, mm-hmm. Cruelty to animals.
This was 1907.
This is 1907.
Right.
So this statue had gone up in the Latchmere Recreation Ground in Battersea. And then I saw that here were feminists and trades unionists combined in these riots against the London University medical students.
Mm-hmm. Now, well, what were they fighting about?
Well, this in itself is extraordinary. Here was London University and its students defending its rights to free vivisection, mm-hmm. and here was this most unlikely conjunction of trades unionists and feminists. Now, if there's one group that loathed the suffragettes, it was trades unionists at this time. What are those middle-class women doing, running up and down, breaking windows and things like this? Haven't they got more, haven't more time on their hands? This, after all, here we are, we poor, bleeding, working men, and we want an extra tanner, and we're starving, and we've got a wife and kids at home. Look at them, look at them. And this was the attitude towards the suffragettes. Mm-hmm. My own forebear, George Lansbury, beloved by the working class, only lost one election in his life, and that was in 1912 in Poplar, when he came out on behalf of women's suffrage. Mm-hmm. Now, the whole working class used to say, oh, yes, we're in favour of women getting the vote, but not when it came to the actual issue. And that was the one election George Lansbury lost, and he was called Petticoat George as a result of this. But here in these Brown Dog riots, I find the most radical borough in London, Battersea, mm-hmm. the stronghold of militant trades unionists, and the suffragettes, Charlotte Despot, the Pankhursts, all conjoined in defence of a brown dog on mm-hmm. this statue.
Well, now, what did the brown dog represent? I mean, here we had a poor animal being cut up and dying over a period of a couple of months.
That's right.
How in the world does that connect with the concerns of women at the turn of the century?
Well, it's rather like looking at an urban landscape. What you see in an urban landscape are the buildings, the footpaths, what you call the sidewalks, but you see buildings erected. Now, if you go to Battersea, and you walk around Battersea, you see the buildings, you see the traffic and so forth. You don't realize that underneath that landscape, there is another buried landscape. At the top of Battersea Rise, there are no very tall buildings. Why? Because the Falcon River runs underneath.
Mm-hmm. So what?
So here we're looking for subterranean motives. People are acting passionately, violently, for reasons very often that they don't understand themselves. Mm-hmm. Now, the working class loathed surgeons and had a particular fear of hospitals at this time. The last anti-vivisection hospital in England was in Battersea. And this in itself is rather remarkable, because these anti-vivisection hospitals were all over working class areas up to this period. Why? Because the working class were terrified that if they went to an ordinary hospital, they would be used as subjects for medical research.
They saw themselves as analogues for this old brown dog.
They saw themselves as victims of research.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them said, those doctors are only chopping up dogs, cats, and guinea pigs because they can't lay their hands on us.
Were they really such villains, these Edwardian surgeons?
Villains? When you find, say, a leading surgeon, 1911, and the Lancet writing, unless we are allowed free access to the undesirables of society, there can be no progress in medical science.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who are the undesirables of society? Who is going to determine that? Is it going to be, say, the Tuskegee Alabama blacks?
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to be the Jews in Mengele's death camp? Who determines this? Well, the working class knew who the undesirables were.
They themselves.
They themselves. And this was always the fear that they were going to be used as subjects. Now, in 1883, when you had Jack the Ripper going around Whitechapel slicing up prostitutes, a kidney was sent in the post from one of the victims to London University.
Oh, my goodness.
There were riots outside the gates of London University because the working class believed, and there is still a long tradition, that Jack the Ripper
was a
vivisecting surgeon from London University. So this was the fear. If you were a charity patient, you were going to be used for research. And even then, beyond that, the fear, not only that you were going to be used for research, but that if you died poor, your body would be dissected.
Mm-hmm.
This is why there's such an emphasis in the working class in the 19th century upon opulent burials. And you find the middle class and the upper classes always say, look at those spendthrifts, you know, the absurdities of the poor. Here they are wasting their few pennies upon burial clubs so that they can be carried to the grave in horses decked with sable plumes and velvet capes. It was because the poor were terrified that their bodies were going to be taken and used for research.
Final consolation.
Yes. If you couldn't enjoy any of the comforts of life while you were alive, at least you could be buried comfortably.
Mm-hmm. Carl Lansbury, we're talking about your book about vivisection, feminism, labor at the turn of the century, The Old Brown Dog. Tell me about some of the noteworthy political and cultural figures with whom you associate with this swirl of events. I was thinking, for example, of George Bernard Shaw, who was against vivisection. On the other hand, we got a lot of these doctors who are pro-vivisection. What about literary kinds of expressions that you use as evidence in this book that you've written?
Well, from the very earliest period, you find, say, Charles Dickens, who can almost enter into the mythic mind of people. And you have Jerry Cruncher, the body snatcher.
Mm-hmm. Now, wait, Dickens, just as a footnote here, pro or con in terms of...
Oh, very, very con. Very much opposed to vivisection, because in,
for example, the kind of thing that he does in Hard Times or Bleak House.
That's right.
Yeah, he's
that's
speaking
right.
for the lower classes.
He really can enter into the minds and feelings, I think, of the poor.
Uh-huh.
So you find Jerry Cruncher, who is the body snatcher, always sucking the rust from his fingers.
Oh, goodness.
But if there's one image that dominates the whole, I think, way that the working class and people generally looked at the conjunction between women and vivisection, you go back to Hogarth.
Mm-hmm.
And Hogarth...
Now, this was the man who was a painter in mid-18th century.
And in 751, you have four plates etched, which provide almost a coloring to the whole mythic consciousness of people. And this is the four stages of cruelty.
Yeah.
Now, in the first plate, you have Tom Nero skewering a dog. You have all the images of cruelty to animals. You have sparrows being blinded, cats being tied together and forced to fight on a lamppost. But Tom Nero, the absolute epitome of cruelty to an animal, a dog. Now, the second plate, you have Tom Nero as a young man. What is he doing? He's got a horse that's collapsed in the traces, and he's flogging it. And behind you see all the images of cruelty, sheep being flogged and goaded off to market. Mm-hmm. Now, the third plate, and one of the most popular of all, and it was the third and the fourth plate which were most widely issued. The third plate shows Tom Nero and his young mistress. She's pregnant, and she's stolen from her mistress.
And we've made a leap here from,
exactly,
well, one animal to another animal.
That's if you right. Wanna, mm-hmm. And the animal is a surrogate for the woman, mm-hmm, because Tom Nero has just murdered his mistress, mm-hmm, and she's lying there in blood at his feet. And the fourth plate, the most telling, I think, and horrifying image of all, shows Tom Nero stretched out on the dissection table in Surgeon's Hall. And although he's dead, he looks alive because a doctor is scooping the eye out from the socket. Oh. His guts have been taken out, and his heart is being devoured by a famished dog, mm-hmm, below the table. Now, here the progression from cruelty to an animal, cruelty to a woman, and final death on the surgeon's table is drawn very clearly. And it's important to remember that Hogarth is not just an artist who hangs in a gallery. Those prints were circulated everywhere, just as Gin Lane was taken up by the, yeah, Temperance Society. Those prints of Hogarth were what television is today. You would find them everywhere, in pubs, at railway stations.
Popular culture.
It was popular culture disseminated in the widest possible way. Mm-hmm. So the natural link between seeing cruelty to an animal and cruelty to a woman is made quite distinct by Hogarth and is perpetuated in literature after that.
Mm-hmm. Now, some of the critical reaction to this book, Coral Lansbury, that you've written about women and labor and vivisection, issues of gender in Edwardian England, it ranges from one critic has called it wise. That's a wonderful compliment. Another critic has said that you are essentially ahistorical, that you've taken a lot of sort of irrelevant cultural and literary evidence and applied it to a historical situation, that it was sort of a condescending review. Here's a writer who really doesn't understand the nature of science. Let me ask you, I'll pick a fight with you. How do you respond to that?
Well, I like being called wise because I think I'm more often foolish than wise.
Uh-huh.
But as to say that I'm not historical, I think my historical method is very clear here. I would place myself very much in the camp of the analyst school. I'm concerned with mentalité, what we now call mentalities in English. I'm more concerned with how people feel than how people necessarily rationally think. You see, if there's one law in history, it's this: that people will always believe what they want to believe, despite all evidence to the contrary.
And you've got a lot of evidence.
There is a lot of evidence here, and you must draw your evidence from a very wide area.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm drawing it from literature. I'm drawing it from borough records. I'm drawing it from, say, works, really, newspapers, but I'm concerned more with popular culture, mm-hmm, in this book. And that is, I think, what some historians have found a little disturbing. It's very hard to quantify or to provide statistics for the way people feel. And often, in a case like this, you find people really acting from the most contradictory motives. After all, I think that's...
Well, you began by telling me about the odd confluence of women and labor
in the
Brown Dog Riots.
Yes, and when women were crying about, you know, the plight of the vivisected animal, more often than not, they were crying for their own condition. After all, this is a time when women, and one of my own great aunts, was being forcibly fed in Brixton Prison.
Mm.
So Lily Lansbury, they ruptured her esophagus, and she always used to speak with a very, you know, while she was being forcibly fed. So that image, that subjection of women. And of course, one area that I examine in this book, which to me was so disturbing, I never thought I would ever be drawn to read this. But again, it's that image I use all the time of the subterranean landscape. You look at that external landscape and then you have to penetrate. You dig and dig and dig deeper, and then you find some very dark rivers running underneath.
Let's talk about an image that is not so subterranean, that is accessible, popular, in fact available directly to children. I'm thinking of Anna Sewell's classic Black Beauty. Is it a great leap for you to use this as literary or cultural evidence in this argument that you were making about women, vivisection, gender at the turn of the century?
Well, Black Beauty is one.
Are we taking a symbol and just stretching it as far as it'll go?
I don't think so. Anna Sewell is, after all, is one of the most popular novels, books ever written.
Mm-hmm.
It was selling 1 million copies a year at the turn of the century.
Well, because it was popular doesn't necessarily make it, turn the argument or turn the symbol on its ear in the direction that you are turning it in. That's what I want you to help me to understand.
Yes, well, let me give you the riposte to that. It's from Dr. Johnson, who, when asked to define literature, said, long continuance and endurance of esteem. So it's lasted a long time.
All right.
And it's still been well regarded. Uh-huh. Dr. Johnson always has the last word, Wayne. But here in Black Beauty, you find all these images of women conflated with horses. After all, it's an autobiography, Black Beauty. Now, although Black Beauty is supposed to be, I don't know, gelding, the name itself signifies a woman, beauty, black, mm-hmm. oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that
a
conjunction,
minority.
A minority there, right. And oppressed. And certainly from the time it was written in 1877, you know, the feeling still of slavery, you're still in the aftermath there of the American Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with Black Beauty, you have it written as an autobiography. And Anna Sewell wrote this on her deathbed. She didn't write it. She dictated it to her mother, Mary Sewell, who was a very famous writer of children's books of a rather homiletic cast. She was a Quaker, and it has almost that feeling throughout it of a testament written on a deathbed. It has an unspeakable honesty running through it. And the issue is not really so much the plight of horses, but the plight of women. You find one image, and it's always been, the book's always been a sort of rite de passage for girls growing up. I remember reading Black Beauty when I was about 12, and I was crying so much, it upset me so much, that it had to be taken away from me. Now, I've spoken to many, many women who've had the same experience with it. But think of Ginger in Black Beauty. Ginger, that high-stepping, proud beauty, who was ridden hard by too many fast young men.
Mm-hmm.
Who's, in effect, gang-raped yeah. into submission.
Well, we're away from symbols there.
And there is language, which I show in my book, The Old Brown Dog,
mm-hmm.
which speaks directly to sexual images. She's speaking mm-hmm. about the use of the curb bit on horses. She's also speaking about something else.
Uh-huh.
Now, tracing that a little further, if you look at contemporary pornography, you find a great change in pornography around this period.
No, wait, you mean then-contemporary pornography.
Then-contemporary pornography.
Right.
And then-contemporary pornography is still the pornography today. If you look at the classic work of pornography of the 18th century, it's undoubtedly The Memoirs of a Woman of Pleasure, John Cleland's Fanny Hill. And Fanny Hill is a bawdy romp. Very good, enjoyable book. After all, there's Fanny. She cheats on him. He cheats on her. And she ends up, after many vicissitudes, happily married to Charles, and all is well.
Mm-hmm.
What's the classic work of pornography? The latter part of the 19th century. It's a work called The Way of a Man with a Maid.
That's right.
And it's quite simply the longest rape in, I hate to use the word literature, but in writing.
And so what have we moved away from? Sex as a sort of fun distraction kind of thing into sex as
from
a sex political...
From sex as body, as a political form of oppression.
Yeah.
And it has a great deal to do with cruelty and oppression.
Uh-huh.
After all, the protagonist of The Way of a Man with a Maid says at the very beginning, it was not for lust or reasons of love that he decided to take her, but for revenge. After all, there's some sort of indication that she may have spurned him. So he catches her, and you have this long, long rape scene. Now, here in this, you find the protagonist is always, in these later works of pornography, either a riding master, and the action takes place in a stable, or a surgeon. Now, the riding master and the language of pornography becomes the language of the stable. A woman is going to be made to show her paces. She's going to be made to take the bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have gynecology emerging at this period. And what is the language of gynecology in this period? Here are women, and God knows the horror of working class women who were put in this position to be examined by groups of rowdy medical students.
Literally strapped down.
Literally strapped down, but right. with their feet in stirrups and on a saddleback. Now, if you have any sensitivity to language, why were those terms used if there was not a connection, a linguistic connection, between the modes of pornography, the attitudes to women, and the practice of gynecology?
You would not attribute it simply to coincidence.
No, no, I don't. I think coincidences are how we like to explain the often circumstantial events of life.
Tell me, Coral Lansbury, how have the issues that you describe in this book, The Old Brown Dog, how have they changed or improved or gotten worse, modified themselves between the time of these riots that you describe in The Old Brown Dog and as we move into the turn of the century? Are we still looking at a pretty grim picture here?
Well, the conjunction of women with animals. You only have to read Gloria Steinem's account of when she worked as a bunny girl.
A bunny, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And so there was a bunny girl strapped up in that most uncomfortable uniform, treated like an animal.
Mm-hmm.
And
are we to extrapolate from the experience of one prominent feminist experience of all women in the 20th century?
No, but I think you will find that women tend to think of themselves in those terms, and certainly they have been regarded at that. A lot of contemporary feminists, contemporary in our terms now, have spoken about this conjunction between women and animals. When I was last in New York, there was something going on at a corner, and I saw obviously some feminists, and on their t-shirts, "We are not animals." Now, this is an issue that's very much to the fore, because it has nothing to do, the way women are being treated in this way, it has nothing to do with lust, love, or anything else like this. It's like rape, which has nothing to do with passion or unbridled sexual passion. It has a great deal to do with submission and authority. And then you come to a definition of cruelty. And people say, well, you know, what is the opposite of cruelty? Well, the opposite of cruelty is not kindness. The opposite of cruelty is liberty and freedom. And what all of this does is to deprive women and animals of their natural freedom.
I'm tempted to tell you about the statue of Old Drum, which stands in the town square at Warrensburg, Missouri. Old Drum was a dog who was a dog that was shot by a mean-spirited neighbor, and his owner happened to be a member of the Missouri legislature, I guess back at the end of the 19th century, the first part of the 20th century. And this man got up and gave a speech in which he used the expression, "A man's best friend is his dog." What do you make of that? Does that in any way set your model on its ear?
Not at all. I always remember the story Russell Baker told, and he said he was horrified when he was in a railway carriage in England. There were two young mothers there with their children, and one mother turned to the other and said, "You know, I far prefer dogs to children." And Russell Baker thought this was appalling.
Oh, goodness.
The next week, someone wrote in and said, couldn't see anything wrong with that. As a child growing up in England, he'd far preferred dogs to parents. Now, dogs really are the children that never grow up.
Mm-hmm.
Children, dogs never disappoint you. Children, dogs never leave you. And dogs have a particularly intimate relationship with people. They are surrogates for family, for children, and often in a family, they are loved far more.
Mm-hmm.
Why not? After all, they never disappoint you, and they love you unconditionally. Who else and where else can you get unconditional love?
Regardless of the way you treat them.
Oh, God, that's what always pains me about dogs, because the more you will treat a dog, the more it behaves as though it has done something wrong.
That's
why I like cats.
Coral Lansbury, let's conclude our conversation. You are the author of The Old Brown Dog, which chronicles a fascinating confluence here of social, sexual, political, religious issues at the turn of the century. You have made the case for all of these issues coming to us in the 1980s. What should we do Is there, you want people to read this book, you want the literary people to look at it from the angle of literary history, the cultural historians. So what? What do you expect from your readers when
if
they look at this?
If people are aware of these issues, if they're aware of these conditions, and certainly of these connections, then I think they will behave differently. I don't think, perhaps I'm like a great many feminists that I believe in raising people's consciousness. Once these links are made clear, then I think attitudes can be changed. Certainly, the attitude of many gynecologists has changed towards their patients, because women are now demanding a different mode of treatment, mm-hmm. and certainly of attitude on the part of doctors. And if you look at the animal rights movement now, it's flourishing, possibly for quite different reasons, I think, than the animal rights movement in the 19th century. I think now it's linked with environmentalism. We realize we live on a very fragile planet, in a very perilous environment, and we have to live circumspectly. We have to live economically. We can't really indulge our passions in the way that we could 100 years ago.
It's a commonplace, Coral, that today what the critic is, if not as important, nearly as important as the original expressive voice. Do you see yourself as some sort of poetic legislator of the world?
No, I can't cast myself in a Shelleyan mold at all. After all, that's a very romantic attitude. But I do think in both my novels and in my academic works, I try to examine certain situations. Now, in my novels, I look at the human condition, and in my academic works, I do the same. Unfortunately, being old and of a sufficiently high rank in the university, I can write what I please. I don't have to write to suit anyone. And that's perhaps the greatest liberty of all.
Coral Lansbury is Distinguished Professor of English and Dean of Graduate Studies at Rutgers University, Camden. She's the author of The Old Brown Dog, Women, Workers, and Vivisection in Edwardian England, published by the University of Wisconsin Press. Coral Lansbury's most recent novel is Felicity, which appeared in the fall of 1987. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Women, Workers, and Vivisection in Edwardian England is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. February is Black History Month. Next week on Soundings, a discussion with one scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center about his forthcoming study of the civil rights movement in the United States. My guest will be Stephen Lawson of the University of South Florida. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Women, Workers, and Vivisection in Edwardian England. This week on Soundings. Listen for Coral Lansbury of Rutgers University, Camden, in a discussion about her new book on feminism, labor, and animal rights in Edwardian England. The Old Brown Dog, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.